Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm with my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And today, we've got another special episode live at ADA Science Sessions in San Diego, California, where we are with Dr. Tim Garvey. So welcome, and if you don't mind just telling our viewers and listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, sure, Diana. I'm Tim Garvey. I'm an endocrinologist. I've been in academic practice my whole career, so I've been interested in insulin resistance and how we can take better care of patients with obesity and diabetes and prevent progression from things like metabolic syndrome and prediabetes to the end-stage manifestations of cardiometabolic disease, of course, which include diabetes and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, dyslipidemia, coronary artery disease risk, et cetera, and eventually chronic kidney disease. So that's kind of the nexus of diseases I'm interested in.
Awesome. And so you, my understanding is that have been instrumental in the SURMOUNT clinical program with tirzepatide.
Yes, we were a trial site for tirzepatide for both patients with obesity without diabetes and patients with diabetes. And it's that latter study, SURMOUNT 2, which the data was presented at this year's at 88.
So can you give us a high-level overview of your talk and your presentation?
Yeah, Natalie, these data, I think, were really well-received at the meeting here. I think they're quite exciting. To start off with, I think it's important to realize with any weight loss intervention, people that have obesity plus diabetes always lose less weight than if there's obesity without diabetes. And we knew from SURMOUNT 1 trial that tirzepatide in patients with obesity without diabetes, very effective, average weight loss above 15%, 17% or so. So the question is, can we find an effective obesity medication that would produce sufficient weight loss in patients that also have diabetes? And keeping in mind that patients with obesity and diabetes have two diseases,
right,
and each warrant effective therapy. If we subjectively forget about the obesity and concentrate on glucose control, but these patients are susceptible to obesity-related complications. Almost everybody has sleep apnea. We mentioned non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, osteoarthritis. So we have to treat the obesity also. So what we found, to make a long story short, tirzepatide was the best drug to date for weight loss in patients that also have diabetes. Weight loss on average was about 15%. Many patients lost more than 20% and 25% as well. So the criteria for FDA approval for obesity is percentage of patients that lose 5% or more, and there was 90% that lost that on the way. So very effective. But I think the amazing thing, in addition to the weight loss, was the effect on hemoglobin A1C. So that came down from a baseline of about 8% down to 5.9% on average, and half the patients below 5.7%, which is a normal hemoglobin A1C. And that occurred without any severe hypoglycemia. At the maximal dose, maybe a 5% rate of level 2 hypoglycemia, which is a blood sugar of 54 milligrams per deciliter or below. You don't have to have symptoms, so it's a mild to moderate level of hypoglycemia. Those rates were very low, 5%. So, I was a medical house officer in the days when we had NPH and regular insulin, and sulfonylureas, and then metformin came along.
Right.
And to think we could get 15% weight loss in diabetes, but normalization of the hemoglobin A1C without severe hypoglycemia, I just thought we'd never see that. And here we are.
Wow, that is incredible. I'm just kind of curious, why is it that in people with diabetes, we see less weight loss compared to those without?
You know, I don't think we understand that scientifically very well. It's multifactorial. Some of the 30% of the patients in SURMOUNT 2 were on sulfonylureas, which can promote weight gain,
right,
and mitigate against weight loss. So some of the associated medications are at fault. But remember, diabetes is a disease of impaired substrate metabolism. There's defects in fat metabolism. There's mitochondrial dysfunction. And so I think some of it has to do with the way diabetics process fuels and the generation of body, sometimes their energy expenditure rates are lower also. So it's multifactorial, but I don't think we really understand it in aggregate.
Wow. So I know the biggest side effect profile of GLP-1s is this GI, we're all worried about the GI side effect. And can you talk a little bit about that GI and what kind of percentages did you get? And on top of that, not only the people that, because I know in trials, if you complain one time, you're marked as an X, right?
Yeah.
But how many people discontinued the drug during the trial, part of the study?
There was about a 7% rate of 7% of we had to discontinue the medication because of side effects, mostly GI side effects.
Okay.
Versus about 3% in placebo.
Okay.
The GI side effects occurred in about 20 to 25% of patients, and particularly nausea, some vomiting, and diarrhea for the three main ones. Nausea was the most common one. But that rarely is unusual. As I mentioned, it kept it discontinued the medicine because of those side effects, because it tended to occur early on when we're escalating the dose of the drug. And then eventually it got better and patients dealt with it pretty well. You can have little tricks to help patients, eat smaller meals, less fatty meals, and kind of work your way. We haven't had to use anti-emetics or anti-nausea medications just by asking, helping them how to manipulate their diet in those ways. Can kind of get the job out. But, this is a side effect of all medications that are GLP-1 receptor agonists.
Right. But that's pretty low overall. It really is.
I thought it was a little lower than some of the other studies I've seen. But, to compare across studies like this, you have to do that very cautiously because these aren't head-to-head comparisons.
I also think, too, once we get this approved for weight loss, when we go back and look at it in clinical practice, we'll be able to say, stay on 2.5 for a month, right? Go more slowly, do it a little differently. In your study, you have to titrate the way they're telling you to, where in clinical practice, the three of us would never do that. We'd say, all right, stay at 7.5 for another 2 weeks or a month or.
Precisely right. Yeah, we have nothing to add to that.
Right, it's just one of those, right, yeah. I'm curious, anything else you're excited about in terms of, we see some research here with other dual incretins or triple incretin therapy, kind of where you see the field going?
We're in a new era of medications to treat obesity, and I view these more effective. I call them second-generation obesity medicines. If you're in the 15% weight loss range, that is sufficient weight loss to prevent and treat a broader way of obesity-related complications. That's kind of a sweet spot for me. That's enough to get predictable improvements in the apnea hypopnea index with the sleep apnea. Of course, the more weight loss, the better in diabetes in terms of lowering hemoglobin A1C, blood pressure, and lipids. And also that's in a range where we can begin to see beneficial effects on non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, NASH, affecting inflammation and fibrosis. So these second-generation medicines are in that range. And now tirzepatide reaches that level of efficacy even in patients that have diabetes as well. It's the first medicine to kind of get us into that range. So we're seeing many medicines in development, largely phase 2 trials here. They're going into phase 3 development at these ADA meetings. They didn't even meet those criteria at the phase 3 level, which are sometimes shorter duration units. So, and we're seeing now other tirzepatide is a GLP-1 GIP dual agonist peptide. We're seeing drugs that combine GLP-1 and glucagon. We're seeing triple agonists that combine GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon together. We're seeing a small molecular weight GLP-1 receptor agonists, which are oral. You don't have to inject them subcutaneously. It's a once-a-day pill that have efficacy in this range as well. Number of companies developing those. So we're in an exciting era of last. I've been waiting for this for a while.
That was like your whole time of research and all of this. We're all in that boat together, right?
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
been this long. And,
yeah.
Okay, what else do we have? What else do we have? And now there is actually something that makes huge difference. These drugs are changing lives.
10 years ago, more of these diabetes meetings, you wouldn't hear much about obesity at all. And then they start having these debates. Should we take a glucose-centric view towards managing diabetes or a weight-centric view? And we have these debates.
Right.
And now I think with these medications like tirzepatide, which I think other than insulin is the best medicine for treating diabetes and the best medicine for treating obesity in the same medicine, the point is we're combining both effects in one medicine. So I was hoping for this day. I don't know if I was going to be able to see it. I'm just very excited about these developments.
Okay, so I love it. Yeah, I'm kind of curious. So obviously there's been like a lot of buzz out there on social media everywhere about tirzepatide, some weight loss in general, just weight loss. You can get it at you can buy it from a pharmacy that's going to compound it, or you can, you know, can you talk a little bit about the guidance that you gave? Part of the trial was people came in and they got weight loss, that they were measured and weighed and you were doing blood pressure analysis. And can you talk a little bit about what's going on with that?
Yeah, Natalie, thank you. I do feel somewhat strong about this. I think the ability to get these weight loss medicines online without an examination or care of a healthcare professional, I think is fraught with danger. We need to surveil these patients for obesity-related complications because, just an example, I had a patient come in to enroll in a clinical trial 2 weeks ago, a 35-year-old male we checked his blood pressure, was 200 over 140, and he had left ventricular hypertrophy on EKG,
right,
and microalbuminuria. And if he got this obesity medicine online, nobody would ever know that this was his blood pressure. He'd go on in an untreated state. He might be dead in 10 years. And so I think this is what we're dealing with when patients have access to this online without the care of a professional. And the compounded molecules, I don't know what's in. These are complicated molecules to make. I mean, it's a peptide with amino acid substitutions and a spacer attached to one amino acid, with a long-chain fatty acid sticking out, which absorbs to albumin and allows it to have longer half-life for a once-a-week injection. And, you know, so it's just a complicated molecule to make, and I don't know what these compounded versions of these drugs are. And so I would think, you know, advocate caution there.
So one of the questions that people ask about is, with all this weight loss, how do you know, is it actual fat loss or not muscle loss? Right, those things that you looked for in these clinical trials.
Well, of course, it's always both, because your muscle mass builds up to accommodate a higher body weight.
Right.
When the body weight goes down, you don't need as much muscle, so the muscle kind of reduces. So the question is this physiologic? Is the weight loss we see with these medicines leads to the amount of lean muscle mass loss that's commensurate with the weight loss? And I think we need to better define that. I mean, I don't think we see a lot of muscle dysfunction in terms of patients having a harder time getting around or impaired activities like you might see in sarcopenia. But I think we need to look at this more precisely, and this is a concern. And let me just add a point there. I think not every patient needs the big bond in terms of, let's get as much weight loss as we can. Let's get that 25%. Let's overlap with bariatric surgery. You know what? The patients can get, they lose too much weight too quickly. I would notice like a fatigue syndrome. Patients can kind of be less sharp cognitively.
Mm-hmm.
You can lose a lot of subcutaneous fat in the face and kind of look older. As people can lose hair as well and develop some level of alopecia. Promote a complication-centric approach to obesity, where it's not the idea to lose X amount of kilograms, but to lose sufficient weight to treat or prevent the complications of obesity, which, after all, are what makes patients sick, which confer the morbidity and mortality. And that's what we do with chronic disease. We prevent complications. You can have sufficient weight loss for those health benefits without having to go to more advanced degrees of weight loss that can be harmful to the patient. So we really need to individualize care from that perspective, which is why I think we need all the obesity medicines we have, not only these second generation medications, and hopefully there'll be more of those in obesity and without obesity, but the first generation medicines that have been around for a number of years. We need all of those arrows in our quiver, as it were, to kind of individualize care, in my opinion.
That's great. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the cardiovascular outcome data? I know we don't have it yet for obesity, but what's kind of your pulse on that? Do you think we're going to get it? Do you think that would, if we did get it would really drive coverage and reimbursement for these drugs?
And ultimately, do I going to say, like with the SGLT2s, as the new data keeps coming out, it's like, it's a class effect. And so now as a prescriber, what I do is I say, what's the least expensive?
Yeah.
Not which one is below 30 GFR, this one's 45, you know, it's like, which is the lowest copay?
Sorry.
Are you actually saying, I will use tirzepatide without a cardiovascular indication because I'm looking for that obesity, right? I have two challenges, right? And as a clinician, are you saying I really need to stick to a semaglutide or a dulaglutide because those do have cardiovascular?
Well, if you read the guidelines that are put out by professional societies, they would say use those drugs with a proven cardiovascular.
Right.
So of course, as you point
Right.
out,
That's right. Exactly.
But that doesn't mean that the other ones in that class don't have those same benefits.
Right.
So if it means patient not having the medication in that class at all because of cost, I would agree with you. I mean, that's what we do. We want to help our patients the best we can and go with the drug that they can have access to, even though these formal studies might not been done. So I'm with you on that. In terms of these weight loss medications, listen, we know with bariatric surgery, there's plenty of studies, there's meta-analysis that show there's a 50% reduction in MACE risk, that's composite cardiovascular outcome, as well as individual coronary artery events, MIs. So that's pretty spectacular. That's a level of weight loss with gastric bypass and Roux-en-Y with gastric application and Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. You know, we're getting close to that with these medicines. So I'm hopeful that the cardiovascular outcome trials that are now on being conducted, we'll have to see what the data show, but I'm hopeful they'll show some cardioprotection there. All of the cardiovascular risk factors get better.
Right.
And there's cardiovascular outcome trials in patients with obesity, with diabetes or without diabetes, and that includes tirzepatide. That includes high-dose semaglutide. So, you know, we just have to wait for the data, but I'm hoping.
So are we.
Yeah. And do you think that will improve insurance coverage overall that we get that data in?
You're assuming a rational approach to healthcare,
Right. That's it.
U.S. healthcare system. And it's not necessarily data-driven.
Right.
But I tell you, you know, I think one of the issues is obesity is such a common disease. A third of Americans have overweight, a third have obesity. We can't treat half of our society with a structured lifestyle intervention or these obesity medicines. It wouldn't be safe or feasible. So to me, it comes down to risk stratification. You could identify risk for future development of diabetes or future development of heart disease and when other complications. We can identify those individuals and bring more aggressive treatments to those at highest risk. Then the patients who are going to need the medicines the most are going to get them.
And
The benefit risk ratio of the intervention will increase, and so will the cost effect. So we've developed some tools to do that. We call it cardiometabolic disease staging. But so a healthcare system or an individual doctor could say, well, I'm going to kind of emphasize treating patients in these higher risk levels. And so the numbers needed to treat to prevent one complication less and start off as lower risk. So, but again, that assumes a rational approach to care because common chronic diseases, and I don't think we're there yet.
Right. Right. Wow. Fascinating. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Any final thoughts or anything you're kind of been most excited about, either at ADA side sessions or kind of in the whole field of obesity?
You know, as a diabetologist my whole career, I just think, you know, becoming more aware of obesity as a disease and a disease that occurs frequently with type 2 diabetes, and the fact that we need to attend to both of those diseases and treat them adequately, that full mindset is just evolving so rapidly. I guess partially driven by the data around these second generation obesity medications, but I just think our patients really stand to benefit with that change and kind of gestalt that we bring to the clinic.
It's exciting times. Yeah, Eric. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Diana and Natalie. It's been fun.
Thank you. And thank you all for tuning in to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue.